darling, oh my darling, Clementine, thou art lost and gone. Hi, welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Christine Franklin.
Hi, guys.
I can also hear Ethan Bolin in the background there. Hello.
Hi, Ethan.
Ethan's our producer. And we're here today to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. One, you know, there are things that just seize the headlines in ways that completely amaze me. Like, I don't know, a few months ago, there was this dumb thing that circulated around on the internet where everybody was trying to figure out the color of this dress. And it was like, I don't care. I just do not care. It's of this, I care not. And yet, people were just obsessed with this for days and days. People just spent their time worrying about this. And this week's, to me, mysterious, you know, passionate, you know, cultural debate. This has been tearing up the United States.
Fights on debate on book face.
People are like, the thing that cracked me up, somebody sent me a thing saying, isn't it wonderful, you know, in an hour of national crisis that we have been blessed with so many people, so many millions of people who are experts on both gorillas and parenting, and the parenting skills of complete strangers. I don't care about this story, but everybody else cares about this. And what interests me is not the story itself, but why does this evoke so much passion in people? You know, I mean, there are real issues going on in the world. So earlier this week, about 1,000 people drowned in the Mediterranean.
Yes, children, little kids, old people, human beings drown in the Mediterranean, and we care about
crickets.
We're
worried about this gorilla, you know, and I get that people get passionate about innocent animals dying, you know, particularly dying at the hand of man. And, you know, especially
better never come here in hunting season. Well, just better stay away.
Well, you know, but there's something about, you know, people don't, when people say they care about animals, typically what they mean is they care about warm-blooded animals that they can feel some kind of emotional empathy with and project things on. So dogs with their big brown eyes, and apes, because apes are kind of like us.
They have thumbs. Yeah.
They remind me of me. But people don't get really passionate, you know, about the death of blood flukes. I don't see big campaigns of people, you know, who mourn the death of oysters.
Although small fish sometimes get protection.
Small fish people can care about because they're cute.
It's like, you know, Finding Nemo. Small fish, Nemo.
Yeah, and so people tend to relate to animals that they can project some kind of emotional connection with. It's hard to have an emotional connection with a housefly or...
But you know, Mark, I think in the garden, you know, before the fall, we were meant to have a relationship with the creatures.
Oh, sure.
And it would have been wonderful, you know? Yeah. Imagine every single wild animal out there that behaved like your dog. You know, happy to see ya, lick you in the face, big old lion kiss. You know, we in our hearts, deep down, we know something's wrong with nature.
Right. Well, there's something wrong with us. You know.
Well, that's all part of it.
We're a major portion of what's wrong with nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's true. The thing is so much of love, quote unquote, love of animals is really a form of narcissism. What it's really about is my feelings about feeling a virtuous person, et cetera, et cetera. And so we project things onto the animal kingdom animals themselves are not worrying about. Cats don't really worry about the mice that they kill. They don't spend a lot of time fretting.
You know, I got to tell you a story about my big, beautiful, smartest dog I ever owned was a great big standard poodle named Carl.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a cancer that was rather viciously growing, oblivious to him, but he was in pain. Right. And we had to make the decision to put him down.
Oh, yeah.
He had no anxiety. We went for a walk. He was happy to see the vet. He was just like all happy to lie down, Carl, and get your shot. You know, mm-hmm. He had no worry, no anxiety. They're not like people.
Right.
They don't have a fear of death. They don't have a sense of, but I should never die. They just lay down. And in the case of my dog, they get a shot and they're in seconds. They're gone. It's the people that are sad.
Right.
But you don't hear the other dogs at the veterinarian all howling in agony because a dog had to be put down, you know? It's a people thing.
Certain animals are capable of feeling mourning, certainly. I mean,
yeah,
we see
sure. Dogs do. Yeah, they do. Dogs but not over mourning. Death.
No. But when we talk about the animals, usually what we mean is something warm and furry. We don't typically mean something cold-blooded or something that doesn't have a face.
Like a spider.
People don't tend to spend a lot of time mourning spiders. And so, you know, I'm not one of those people who's heartless, you know. For example, I resented, you know, there are people who deliberately go to hunt, you know, endangered big game in Africa so that they could feel, you know, all badass.
So they can take the head home.
Yeah, and I find that just disgusting.
I do too. And I find, I wonder if it borders on sinful because it's, I mean, I'm a moral theologian here, okay? So, but to kill something for the thrill of killing it and the trophy feels wrong to me.
Yeah.
And you can call up and yell at me if you want. What's the number, Mark?
Oh, yes. Give us a call. 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can call and chew us out if you like.
Yeah. If you're a big game hunter with a zebra head on your wall, call us and yell at us. But I think there's something really disturbing.
Direct all praise to Christine Franklin and all to me.
No, you can yell at me. I find it disturbing. Trophy hunting disturbs me on we're not hunting for food here.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, yes, that is disturbing.
What's the thing that bugged me about the story was not, it's not either side of the controversy. It's the fact that people felt that they needed to find someone that they can sit in judgment of. And so you get, I mean, the whole United States is, for this week, divided up into two factions of, you know, people who are there to sit in judgment of the awful parents who allowed their child to get lost, because that's never happened, ever.
Yeah.
Where it ever lost a child in a big public place. To which my reply is, let me introduce you to the Holy Family.
My grandkids.
You know, if the Blessed Virgin Mary can lose track of Jesus for 3 days, it can happen to anybody. And it happens all the time, every day.
He knew better.
Yeah, and so I'm, on the one hand, the whole, we must sit in judgment of these awful parents. My response to it is, why is it my job to sit in judgment of people I don't know about circumstances I have no familiarity with? I've certainly had my kids disappear sometimes. You know, in a crowded space, and not because I'm a bad parent, but because that's just one of those things that happens.
And you know what? It's always scary when it happens and you feel terrible.
Right.
You know, it's just like, they are just, unless they're strapped to your body, they are hard to keep, you know, they have a mind of their own.
That's
and
right.
I think what was so sickening to me was within a day of the gorilla being put down, which is what he was. He was put down. Mm-hmm. There was a petition going around to make the family responsible for the death of the gorilla. In other words, sue the family. I don't know what a gorilla like that costs. Thousands and thousands.
I'm sure. Yeah.
A lot. Sue the family for their negligence because the poor gorilla had to be put down.
Yeah.
And it's like, what?
Happened, you know? But, you know, at the same time, the other side of it that I'm also, you know, I'm commanded by people on the internet to, I must sit in judgment of the people who shot the gorilla. They're the worst people ever. And, you know, and I'm like, they did their job.
Yeah.
You know, that was what they.
Why didn't they just tranquilize the big boy? You know, like, there's really good reasons.
You might miss. You might, you know, there's all kinds of things.
Actually, I read a great article by the zookeeper who's in charge of that gorilla.
Really?
And she said, yes, it was a really wonderful article to try to clarify maintenance or care of, they're called class one animals in the zoo. And it's anything that can kill you. You know, okay. So there's very strict rules. For instance, the zookeepers themselves never have any contact with the animals awake. They have to be tranquilized to be veterinized. In other words, lions, tigers, bears, and 400-pound gorillas. She said never. She said, second of all, if you tranquilize that gorilla was dragging that little kid around in a display fashion, prompted by the screaming of the crowds. And she said, that is a power position that a male gorilla, who's the boss, does. He'll take anything in his cage, a branch, he'll cut it, he'll break a tree in half and drag it around to show that he's boss. And he was doing display behavior with the child by picking it up by the arms. It's like, I'm the boss and I'm going to show you. And they drag it and they beat it and they drag it around as a... So the everybody who says, it looked like he was trying to protect the boy, they don't know what they're talking about. This woman went on to say that if you tranquilize a 400-pound gorilla, first of all, it takes a while for it to work. He could kill the child in the process. Okay. Second of all, a tranquilized gorilla could fall on the child, a 400-pound gorilla, and kill the child. Right. Or the tranquilized gorilla could fall into the moat on the child and drown the child. There is no other choice and no other protocol but to take a hit.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots, Catholic Radio's most majestic hour.
Yeah, and we flubbed that break, but...
We flubbed the break.
We are so fallible. We're just fallible human beings, and sometimes you flub the break. But I want to finish talking about the gorilla. It's really short. Okay. So, the gorilla... got shot because that is exactly what they're supposed to do when a dangerous animal gets in contact with a human being. Period. No other options. Period. Humans first. Yeah. And the zookeeper, who loved that gorilla very much, said it is a great tragedy and a great loss, but that was the right thing to do.
Of course it was.
And so today, on the mom of the little boy went online and made a statement. She thanked Jesus up and down for saving the life of a little boy's three, saving the life of that child. She says, I turned to do something, and the next thing we knew, he was over the wall. And isn't that just so typical of a three-year-old?
Sure. Those kinds of things.
And she just couldn't go on and on and on about how grateful she was to the zoo, how sorry she was about the loss of the gorilla, but how grateful to God she was to have her child. And I think if people for one moment put the face of a child they love on that little boy, they would have said, take the kill shot.
Of course.
And that's what we lack. I think that's something that's going down, down, down in our culture, is that ability to put ourselves in someone else's position and say, oh my gosh, that would be terrible. That would be terrifying. All I would want is my baby back. I don't care about a gorilla. Kill the thing and give me my kid.
Well, and that's the thing is, you know, when I talk about screwy priorities, this is just a no-brainer. If a child's in danger, there it is. And, you know, golly, do kids get away from their parents sometimes?
Totally.
Well, yes,
we do our best.
Genius for this.
Yeah,
it's amazing. You know, I've got a little granddaughter named Seraphim, and she she is just exploring her world all the time. And you try to, you know, you try to childproof the house and do all of those things. But there's always that moment when you could hear her banging around in the den because she's got toys and she's playing with stuff and she's singing a song and she's doing all these things. And then it kind of dawns on you after a minute or two, and that's all the time it takes, that she's gotten really quiet. And that's always
like, danger, danger.
Oh, I'm going to sign, right? She's real quiet, and your first thought as a parent is, what is she doing? Is she sticking her tongue in a light socket? Who knows? No. You go in there and you find out that she has, you know, she has located the pin cushion that you had put up out of her reach that you thought, and now she was just about to, you know, do some crazy thing with the pin cushion that was going to kill her.
I had a terrible scare with my little girl when she was 3 and a half. Very good
at the age of this kid.
Very good at following instructions. Okay. Right. Okay. But actually really very good at following instructions. And we were out at Penrose Point State Park and we had to cross a thigh deep rivulet to get to the clam digging place. I sat her down and I had to carry the buckets and stuff across. I sat her down on the one bank of this little creaky thing and it was just a wade across, you know, I said, you stay here. You stay on your bottom till mommy or daddy comes back and get you. We will be right back. Mm-hmm. I got to the other side of the bank, turned around, and my daughter was face down in the water.
Yikes.
I grabbed her. She gasped. She didn't get any water. She was fine. I said, you didn't mind mommy. Now you got all wet and cold. She cried a little bit, and she was fine. Okay, that night, we're done clam digging. I'm taking a bath. And I burst into tears and started shaking all over because of what could have happened. And I'm telling you, I'm a good mother and she's got a good dad. And she wasn't, you know, it's like, what do you do? You know, was I terribly, horribly neglective to have my kid now sit down there and stay there when she normally would have done just that and sat there and picked up rocks? Mm-hmm. And it was in the moment it took me to cross that probably 5 feet of creek and she was on her face in the water.
Yeah.
And, you know, to blame the parents is just wrong. But I want to know, and I don't know the answer to this, and maybe a caller has an opinion. What has happened in America to where the life of a creature is so much more valuable than the life of a child?
I don't know. I mean, part of it is this urge that we've got. I think it's partly the windshield effect again. The windshield effect is it's that thing on the internet that allows you to feel like there's a piece of glass between me and the person that I'm sitting in judgment of.
Yeah.
And people just let fly, you know, with, wow, these are bad parents.
Assign a
suspicion. They're guilty of murder. And it's like, it's not murder when you shoot an animal. Murder is not the right word. And you're muddying things when you start talking that way.
And when we were kids, Mark, if that same thing had happened at Point Defiance or Woodland Park, the zookeepers who took the shot would be getting a medal.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. 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 And so, you know, I look at that and I look at all the other stuff that people could have spent their psychological energy on this past week.
Yeah.
Like 1,000 people drowning in the Mediterranean who were just trying to get away from bombs. And that's just silence. Nobody talked about that.
I saw a sickening picture of a city in Syria where the streets were actually running with blood this week.
Wow.
From bombings and shootings and killings. It was like biblical, running with blood. And we're worried about a dead gorilla. And I thought, how did we get here? Yeah. Because some of the people who were urging me to sign this petition are very good people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not jerks. They're right. animal lovers and animal advocates, but they aren't bad people. They're people who go to church every Sunday, you know? And how did we get to where human life is so cheap?
Yeah.
And that people can't gasp and put themselves in the position of that mother or that terrified child being picked yeah. up by the arms by a great big enormous animal
yeah.
and have sympathy and weep for that mom and those minutes of terror that they experienced, you know? Yeah. How did we get here?
Yeah, the I don't solution. Know. It's mysterious. Well, I do think it is. There's a kind of a narcissism involved in a great deal. Not all of it. I mean, there's a legitimate Christian place for caring for creation.
And totally.
So I'm not one of those people that says any concern about animals is just automatically contemptible. I think that there are really cruel people in the world who really do like. They like harming animals because it makes them feel powerful, and that's why they do it.
Or they kill all the wild gorillas because you can get $1,000 for a gorilla's hand to send to China for some rich guy to have gorilla hand soup.
Yeah,
that's wrong.
Yeah, but you know, at the same time, there is a great deal of. It's cheap. It's easy, you know. I'm concerned about this animal, and I like the feeling of sitting in judgment of these people that I don't know anything about, you know. And certain things, there are certain sort of culture war aspects to it. So, when somebody expresses gratitude to Jesus because their child wasn't killed. Well, that's a red flag for any number of people. She said Jesus. You know?
Yeah.
We hate her, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, I'd be grateful to Jesus too if my son was at risk of dying and his life was saved, you know?
Yeah.
But that's the thing is people respond to stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so there's all kinds of culture war stuff that comes into it and all kinds of little dog whistles that go off in people's ears that only they can hear. And so they kind of gravitate. Well, it is, you know, I mean, it's one of those things that happens. Right? She said Jesus. I hate people who talk about Jesus. And so, and plus an animal died. So that means that she is my culture war animal.
Well, and she has too many kids.
And she has too many kids. And it would have been better if one of them died. And you really do get that kind of, you know.
That's horrific. That is horrific. Horrific.
You know, but, so there's all of that that goes into the mix. That's where, to me, I look at it and I just think, stop. What are our priorities? You know, and our priorities are supposed to be. I mean, we heard the gospel priorities today. What are the two greatest commandments? That's the gospel reading. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's where you start. And everything else proceeds from those two commandments. So,
I'll return after this. I'm listening to you connecting the dots. This marks the
dots. Christine Franklin will be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Thank you.
Mark Shea. We're here today with Christine Frank. Talking a bit about
our screwy cultural priorities. The gospel priorities are remarkably straightforward and extremely difficult for our civilization to cope with. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Well, that's, you're already in trouble right there with a considerable percentage of postmodern culture. The second commandment, which is like unto it, says Jesus, is you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That would seem more straightforward, and I think most people still intuitively get that one. But at the same time, of course, what we immediately start looking for are exemptions to that rule. Mm-hmm. Who can we exclude from that commandment because we hate them or because they're in our way of whatever it is we need to do?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's so much of the violence and conflict that we see in the world is exactly because those commandments, first of all, are set out of order. One of them is often set aside completely. So the obligation to love your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength gets set aside for all kinds of reasons. Who do we mean by God? You know, that kind of thing. And what does it mean to love him? Aren't we, you know, if I love God with my mind, doesn't that make me an intellectual slave? And people, I'm not allowed to think for myself. And all those kinds of things come up. But the other one, the one that we still can see the point of it, love your neighbor as yourself. So much of our civilization is predicated on trying to figure out exemptions to that or not being clear on who your neighbor is. So given a choice between a child and a gorilla, which one is my neighbor? Her. This is not a problem for somebody with their head screwed on straight. But for an awful lot of people, this is a huge problem. What if the gorilla is my neighbor and the child isn't?
And I know you laugh, but I actually think there are people who feel that way.
Oh, sure.
And about their pets as well, you know, about their pets as well. Never call me a dog mom. Okay. Just don't even go there because the dog is a dog, you know? Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people who talk about their pets as though they were their children. And, well, I'm sorry, that creeps me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, we're living in this time. I was just reading an article today. You know, we're always looking. Different people spend tremendous amounts of time looking for ways to exclude people from the human race.
Yeah.
So that they can, you know, do whatever it is they feel they need to do to those people in order to, you know, exempt them from the kind of decency and common sense and charity that we owe every person because they're made in the image and likeness of God. You know, I was just reading today, there's a new little thing among the anti-Semites who are unfortunately they are among the many dreadful, terrifying people who are form the backbone of support for Donald Trump.
Oh, that's disgusting.
And so there's a little signal that you might notice this at some point in your travels across the internet. If you see a person or an idea placed in triple parentheses. So, for example, if you see someone's name, mm-hmm. put triple parentheses.
Uh-huh.
Time was when that was sort of it was an internet way of hugging somebody.
That's what I thought. It was a hug.
Well, and it still is. For decent people like you. But it's also become used in a very sinister way. And basically, the point of it is you put someone or an organization an idea in triple parentheses. And it's a signal of this person is a Jew.
This person,
this is a Jewish idea.
Oh my goodness.
And so it's among other things, it becomes a signal to feel free to harass this person for being Jewish. Goodness. It's vile. It's one of many gazillions of strategies that we humans come up with for finding somebody that we can exclude from the commandment to love your neighbor as yourself. And we find different ways of doing it for different groups of people, depending on what our obsessions and bigotries and hatreds and fears are. But that's the what it has in common always is, how can I exclude the people that I want to exclude from the commandment to love my neighbor as myself? Yeah. So that's one contemporary example. But of course, human history is full of examples.
Yeah.
And we're all tempted to do it. There are all people that typically hatred begins in fear. You fear somebody, mm-hmm. you feel you have to defend yourself against them, and so you gin yourself up to...
Or hatred comes from, hey, people have something I don't have.
Right. Or they've done something that was really wrong, too. I mean, there's
sure.
You hate people because of some historical grievance or whatever. And this is why Jesus commands us to forgive, of course, which is the hardest part of all of Catholic teaching. There's nothing harder than the command to be merciful. And true. Everybody looks for some way to get out of it because, man, having mercy, Shakespeare says, where to serves mercy but to confront the visage of offense.
You go to confession and you haven't been forgiving towards someone, it's mm-hmm. really tempting to explain why.
Right.
I don't know if anybody else has ever had that problem.
Yeah, it's coming. You know?
It's like, and here's why I don't forgive this person.
Reason, of course, is they don't deserve it. And right, I mean, that's the point.
Isn't that terrible? In the confessional, I don't forgive. I'm not forgiving this person. Well, but here's what he did to me.
Right, and one of the great freeing things to discover is mercy doesn't mean you have to pretend that they didn't do something wrong.
Totally.
This is not. When God commands us to forgive, he's not saying, you have to look me in the eye and lie to me and say to my face that that guy meant well, when he obviously didn't mean well. We could be talking about very serious sins. Most of the sins that we have to forgive are... he was...
Yeah, they're paltry, mostly.
Yeah, he lost his temper. For a minute, or he took something petty that I don't really care all that much about anyway. I mean, that's the kind of thing that most of us have to struggle with. Now and then, of course, there are huge things requiring forgiveness. Rape.
I know all about that one, yeah.
And terrible, terrible thing. You had a guest on your show. Rachel Muha?
Yeah.
Whose son was murdered. And
brutally tortured and murdered.
A monstrous crime. And the amazing thing is that she has chosen forgiveness for the guys who tortured and killed her son. Yeah. That takes supernatural grace.
Forgiveness, but standing up in front of the judge and pleading against the death penalty.
Wow.
On his behalf.
Yeah.
The state where they tried him, it was a death penalty offense.
Yeah.
So they were there at the sentencing and they stood up and made a statement. And it's like, wow, that is supernatural grace.
It's inexplicable.
It's inexplicable apart from grace. God. Yeah.
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 And so you look at things like that, and that's the astonishing thing about the gospel promises. The gospel promises right off the bat, from the get-go. It says, that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. It's, of course you don't deserve mercy.
Right.
That goes without saying. So to come before God and say, you know, I refuse to have mercy on this guy because he doesn't deserve it. Nobody deserves mercy. That's why it's mercy.
Yeah.
And that spectacular outpouring of undeserved love, which just goes on and on and on through the ages.
Yeah.
That's the most amazing, to me, the most amazing quality of the gospel.
It is. There's no other explanation for it.
Yeah.
There isn't.
Yeah, I read about it, one of the things, the way that the Big Bang is described, you know, is all of, you know, the entire universe just sort of pouring out of this bottomless funnel of create, like a cornucopia that just comes pouring out of literally nowhere.
Out of nothing.
It comes into the universe. And that's what the mercy of God is like. You can't look at the mercy of God and explain.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
And welcome back to Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Christine Franklin. We've been having a somewhat meandering conversation, but we haven't really gotten to the heart of things yet.
Most important thing we left for last.
And that important question is this. Why is it that people don't like Wesley Crusher?
I don't understand it, and I really hope a Trekkie will call in and explain it to me, because I've just started going through the Next Gen again from the beginning, because I've been recovering from shoulder surgery, so what else can you do? Okay. So, I'm going through Next Gen. I started with Next Gen, and it's like, why do people hate Wesley Crusher? Why?
I can't really explain why, but I have to say that for some reason, I don't like him either. I think.
And you know what? I confess. He's annoying.
There's something about him that's annoying.
I don't understand. But man, Picard back in the day, he was looking good. He actually had some hair on the sides there.
Well, yeah, he's pretty distinguished fellow, you know. It helps. Yeah, the British accent really covers a multitude of sins, too.
It does, and a multitude of bad acting, too, which I'm realizing when you compare modern television and, say, the modern Star Treks to even, quote, old Next Generation Star Trek, boy, is it slow.
Well,
it is slow.
Well, you know, I always thought that Kirk could, you know, there was always a win, and clearly it would be because, you know, Picard would be... Quoting,
oh, he never fought. Did he ever punch anyone?
No, I don't think he ever did. Yeah, see, that was the thing.
He never ripped his shirt. He never hit anyone. You know, number one, had to do all of that for him. But if you want to see fisticuffs, you got to see Captain Archer in his eyes.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, Archer
likes beats the pulp out of everybody.
Yeah. Okay. I was always disappointed that Janeway never really got to duke it out with anybody either.
No, but, she really didn't duke it out. Who duked it out on that show?
I'm trying to think. Not too many people.
There wasn't a lot of duking it out.
Just wasn't. Yeah. Well, they particularly went for the whole, you know, notion of leotard clad
everyone
conflict resolution counselors in space. On Star Trek, and I, for one, prefer Captain Kirk. Just,
you know, I like that he, you know, disregarded the prime directive all.
Yes,
the time. Archer, if you go to Enterprise and you watch Archer, there's no such thing as the prime directive yet. So he's free to bust people's in the face all the time, and he does. Plus, phaser technology was not as advanced by that point. So, you know, later Star Trek, they had really, really finely tuned phasers, so their weaponry was improved, and it was really easy to just stun them all to the ground.
And better leotards for the conflict resolution counselor too.
Yes, leotards.
So that was important. But they were just kind of the UN in space, you know, just going around trying to get people to not fight with each other. And
yeah, even the Vidians who stole organs, which I thought was interesting, since that happens actually now all over the world.
Yeah,
organ stealing.
Not quite to the degree that those guys do it, though. But
no, not quite as technologically savvy as they are. You know, when Neelix lost his lungs, I just didn't know what I was going to do, but, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, how can they take his lung? They took Neelix's lungs. Of course, they made him holographic lungs that were good for a while. So,
yeah.
You know, I'm glad things work out. It's good for recovery from shoulder surgery and when you're on narcotic painkillers.
Yeah, there's a lot less to think about. But I don't have an answer from a Catholic perspective on why people didn't like Wesley. There are just some things that are mysterious, you know?
And that is one of the mysterious things about Star Trek and the fan world. If you go to a convention, no one is dressed as Wesley. I'm telling you, they will be thrown out so fast. Who are you? Oh, I'm Captain Kirk, or I'm Captain Picard, or I'm the red shirt. But no one will admit to being Wesley Crusher.
Yeah.
And you have whole gangs of Klingons.
The funny thing is, though, is that Will Wheaton, who played Wesley Crusher, he goes around to the various sci-fi cons and shows up, you know, and people like him well enough, and he seems to have survived the child star thing. Okay, there is no worse fate that I could possibly imagine visiting on my worst enemy. Then
to be a child star.
Doesn't it sound horrible? And you know, with such rare exceptions, they all grow up to be terribly damaged people. A lot of them do,
unless their parents get them out of the business when they need to, you know, at a good time. But I think it must be greedy parents. I really have a hard time believing. Now, I had a kid who was really loved to entertain when he was 3, 4, 5, and he was pretty cute at it. But, you know, it would have had to be our initiative to do anything with that. I have a feeling that child stars, it's all about mom and dad. Don't you?
I get that sense. Yeah, they just don't seem to be happy people. And so many of them, when they grow up, you know, they basically say, you're not my mother, you're not my father. They just, like, completely reject their parents, you know.
Drew Barrymore, when she was the little sister in, what was that, E.T. years and years ago. By the time she was, like, 10 years old, she was going to cast parties with adults and snorting coke and stuff. And it's like, really? What kind of...
Yeah.
Is this, and then we like this kind of entertainment? Well,
and I got to say, she seems to be one of the few people that came out of this with relatively intact. I mean, she did dig herself out. Yeah. But
got a lot of pain.
Just a dreadful fate. You know, it's just, but it's that whole thing is a strange culture. You know, I've done, before I was an English major, I was a theater major. And, It's a very strange culture, and it's a culture.
I was too. Hey,
oh, you were really?
Comment. Yes,
I did not know that.
What's the best role you ever had?
Oh golly, the best role I ever had. I think the best role, the most fun role I ever had was I was in a little play called Bullshot Crummond that was a comedy that was based on 1930s British detective serials, namely Bulldog Drummond, and. Anyway, one of the conceits of those films was that you had this sort of stock cast of character actors who showed up again and again and again in these different movies playing different characters. And so what they did in the play was they had one guy be the entire supporting cast. He played everybody. Everybody oh, that was God. So he's like the hero's best friend and the snooty waiter at the restaurant and the aged scientist who's the father of the heroine and
is it a one man show then?
No. It had five people in the cast.
Okay.
But it had like 13 characters, and so I played the entire supporting cast. So it was like all this quick change stuff where you would step off stage, and there'd be a team of people there who would rip your clothes off and put different
been there, on you. Done that.
And you'd walk back out 2 seconds later as an entirely different character.
Yeah.
And so that was I think the most fun I ever had on stage was playing that character, those characters. And
mine was my best, funnest, most fun comedy I ever got to do was I was Mistress Page in The Merry Wives of Windsor.
Oh,
so I got to do the bard. I got to crawl around behind furniture and spy on people. We had a wonderful Falstaff.
Hello?
And my son was in the play with me, so that was a lot of fun. And in college, I played a nun.
Okay, good.
Oh,
that would be fun. That would be great fun.
Yeah,
I never got a chance to do Shakespeare. I would love to have done that, but just
you'd be a great Falstaff. Oh my goodness! The beard is real.
The beard is real, and the fat is real. Yes,
and the jolly.
Well, that's what I
go. All you need is some sack.
Yep. Yeah, that'd be fun. I'd love to do that again. One of the things that I sort of daydream about, theater requires, and this is why people involved in that profession tend not to have stable homes. Theater involves an enormous amount of time away from home.
And it involves a lot of emotional energy. And so when you do get home, you're like, feed me. Right.
Emotional energy, and of course, emotional energy, which only in that field do you regularly wind up passionately kissing people that you're not married to.
I know I had to kiss somebody in a play, but I was.
That takes a toll after a while, you know, on relationships. Yeah. So you see that kind of thing. But nonetheless, I've loved doing it in the past. And I'd love to be able to return to that. One of my little fantasies is once my kids are like gone and away, I might go try to do some more
community theater is a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. People really put everything into it, and it's done out of love, you know, just pure love of the art itself. And that's fun too.
Yeah, and I imagine up in your area, you can get some pretty good directors for community theater, too.
Well, guys. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Christine Franklin. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer, Stephen Bolin. Our director of orchestral awesomeness, Ron Beethoven. And I will be back tomorrow with Steve Gardonis. Until then, have a lovely evening. Bye-bye.
Later.